First, it is possible to meet Michaela Braun outside of business. Second, it needs patience. Third, it's worth it. My name is Johanna, last name Schwab. I will be living in New York City for the next 6 months. As a lover of fashion and its invisible power, of words, voices and questioning, I had the idea to start a podcast. You will be getting a mix here. I'll put my soliloquies on record and do what I like the most. Talk to people whose work and thoughts I find inspiring. This podcast is called Refashion New York City. Michaela Braun created her own business model, combining her PhD in anthropology and her love for fashion. Michaela Braun is a fashion anthropologist, which, breaking it down, means before you say wow, ask why. She is also the creator of Sidewalk Safaris, a city tour, which she describes intriguingly. We are going to disco deep dive into Harlem using fashion as our lens. This walk is to get to know Harlem as the starting point of black fashion in America, as much as today's Harlem and the importance of community in keeping small and diverse businesses. When I met Michaela, she was in the middle of launching similar tours in Atlanta and LA. By the end of next year, she wants to have them in 10 American cities. This talk is recorded in a cafe in Harlem. We are sitting outside next to a busy street. It still feels like summer, even if it's the 1st of October. We just came from a 2-hour sidewalk safari and we still are surprisingly energized. Michaela's power is contagious. I decided to publish this conversation, even if the background sounds try to overtake. I am so happy that I had a chance to talk to her. Meeting her was from the sort, encounters you will never forget. We are starting with my word game.
It's like a little game. I just say the word and you tell me what comes in your mind.
Wonderful.
Telling me, like, wonderful. When I say that word. The first word is wardrobe.
Wardrobe. Identity.
And the next word is confidence.
Authentic.
Basic.
Uninspired.
Style.
Everything.
DIY.
The word I'm coming up with is like constructive. Like what I think about DIY is that you're creating something that didn't exist outside of the world, outside of you. So I don't know what that word is, but do you get what I'm saying? Like maybe contribution. DIY is like your contribution to the world, because without you, DIY, without you, it can't exist, right? Yeah.
Nice. Must have.
Different for everyone.
Passion.
Life's purpose.
Detail.
What makes something special? It's the uniqueness of things.
It's two more.
Okay.
Patchwork.
Patchwork. Community.
Mainstream.
Necessary but never preferred.
Nice. So you call yourself a fashion anthropologist.
Yes.
And you made up that word, or is it something you called yourself?
Yes, yes. I would say I coined it, but it has existed in academic circles for years. But I think I'm one of the first people to use it as a business model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how does it come? Like, you studied anthropology?
I did. I have my doctorate in anthropology. And I've always had a love of fashion. It was only about 4 years ago that I could put the two together. Because in many ways, now we live in a time where things are hybrids and conglomerates of different ideas. When I was 20 years ago, when I was thinking about what I wanted to be in the world, there wasn't these in-between spaces the way they are now. Because of the gig economy, because of companies like Uber and Facebook and Twitter, it's created this space where people can do things that aren't so black and white. When I first was becoming a professional, things were very binary. So for me, fashion anthropology grew out of this ability to create a space for myself in the world that made sense, but kind of lived in between two things, which is culture and fashion.
Mm-hmm. And also, we came just from your tour, which is called Sidewalk
Safaris, yes.
Also something you were inventing, or?
Yes, yes.
So maybe you can tell something about that.
Sure.
What are they about? How did you come up with that idea?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I call them sidewalk safaris because when you go on a safari, you're acutely aware that you're paying attention to every detail, and you're aware that you're entering a world outside of your own, but you're paying attention to the details, and you're observing how somebody's, an animal or a person's culture is different than yours. I became a fashion anthropologist because subconsciously, as I was walking the streets, I was scanning people and looking for clues of who they are. I'm an extrovert, and a part of being an extrovert is understanding people and making them feel comfortable. So as an extrovert, one of the ways I could make people feel comfortable to engage with me as a stranger was to understand them. And so clothing became kind of a roadmap for me. So I was paying attention to tattoos and the particular earring you wore and how you did your makeup and how you styled. And it made me realize at points that it was the sidewalk became this incredibly nuanced and exciting other world that I got to observe and really engage with, even if it was something outside of what I was familiar with. So I initially wanted to have a travel show. I loved Anthony Bourdain. I loved what he was doing with food. I wanted to do that for fashion. But I wouldn't have networks beating down my door. So the tours really were inspired by a need to monetize. Like, how do I make money from being a fashion anthropologist? I could be an academic, which is something I never wanted to do exclusively. I always wanted to be a business person. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So how do I monetize this intersection between fashion and culture? And I was going to do that research anyway. The tours allowed me to share it with people. Not only to make money from it, but also to connect with people on an individual level and say, hey, let's look at this differently together and let's all learn together. I'll be honest, at first it started, I was like, I just want to make money doing what I love. But the more I did it, the more I realized it was my sole purpose, that I was always meant to be doing this. And I had my own fashion line for 4 years, and I love fashion. I'm obsessed with fashion, but it never fulfilled me the way that this does now.
Why did it not?
I think the fashion industry is an amazing industry, but I think it puts a lot of undue pressure on creatives. The proliferation of seasons, you know, back in the day we had 4 seasons, now we have like 16.
Yeah.
That needs to constantly be putting out output, engaging new customers. That felt like a chore.
Yeah.
I just wanted to create. And I found being a fashion designer, there were almost too many rules. I felt stifled.
Yeah.
What I like about my company now is there are no rules because no one else is doing it. So I get to make it my own. And I miss the part of the culture. So I had a socially conscious fashion line. So I talked a lot about culture within the collection, but not to the degree that I do now. And I like the tours because I hope that it makes people think more critically about their own style and their own fashion.
Yeah.
I think people think of fashion as a very superficial industry, but it says so much about who you are. And so I wanted to empower people, in particular women, to be self-narrators. Like, I wanted them to be part of the narration of who you are to the world. So, like, rather than unconsciously putting on a dress that you bought because you saw it on a Kardashian, I want you to think about why you like that dress, why you like that color, why that cut worked with your body. It celebrated your Latin hips and your curves. Like, I wanted to tell that story. That's somewhat harder to do with a fashion line because you mail out the clothes and they have it. But there's not much of a discussion. They come on the website, they like it, they wear it. The tours are a way where I can actually control the narrative and, like, really engage much more deeply.
Yeah.
About clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. And, like, it's like this umbrella project.
Yes.
You're doing is called, if I Common Thread.
The project. Common Thread Project, yep.
And I love the teaser, or how you write about it. It's like, for me, it's a teaser where you say, like, where Van Gogh, Gucci sneakers, and female barbers aren't nearly as unrelated as they seem.
Right, right.
What do you mean by that for someone who, you know?
So the cool thing about being an anthropologist is that you learn how history, politics, culture all come together to create a community as a society. And that happens with fashion. Such a good example, we were just on a tour and someone pointed out how the bubble of the 80s, followed by a recession in the early 2000s, affects the way fashion is impacted today for local fashion artisans. I think it's such a complex, intricate story, and like, fashion can be this amazing, it's like your favorite book. You love that book because you can deep dive into the characters and learn the nuances and, like, you learn about the history of their mother and how it affects them now and how they date and their community and like the favorite foods. Like, it all comes together to tell the story of a person. And fashion is just like that. Like, you can't divorce fashion from politics. You can't divorce fashion from history. You can't divorce fashion from culture. And why would you? Because it only makes the fashion better. Because it's a story. So for me, I think about fashion as art, but I think of it as a story. Like, it's telling a story. And, like, that's so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are really excited about it once they start thinking that way, but we're not programmed to think that way. So I see my company as a mission to push people to just think more critically about fashion so that they enjoy it more. It's so much more than just, like, it makes me look pretty. It's telling your story. It's telling the story of the designers, telling the story of the artisans who use their hands to make it, the person who, like, worked at the mill who made the fabric. Like, all that comes together to make this, like, beautifully intricate tapestry. It's, like, so awesome.
Yeah. And, like, in this case, like, it's maybe naive, but is there really a relation for you for, like, Van Gogh, Gucci sneakers, and or is it just, like, to...
No, so... That's Harlem. Like, all those things are Harlem. And so in Harlem, fashion can be Dapper Dan, which is luxury, one of the few black designers in luxury. So the most opulent fabrics made in Italy brought here. But then you go two blocks down, and it might be another boutique that it's all about, you know, that's where the abuela shop, you know, because they love the fabric that's there. Like, for me, it's about neighborhoods and communities as much as about fashion. And, like, what fashion lines or what small fashion businesses make sense in a neighborhood, it's telling the story of that community.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, especially a place like Harlem, there's people who are, like, third-generation Harlemites, and then there's people like me who moved here because we're ambitious and we want to make the most of the world. But we all live together, side by side, right on top of each other, and we all contribute to the culture of this place. And I might, if you had asked me, do I have a lot in common with someone who's been in Harlem for like 10 years? I'd say, no, I'm Jamaican. I grew up in Florida. I'm so different. But being forced to live in a neighborhood together, we have formed this community and that bond that we are connected. And some of that is through clothing. And I love that. I love that. It's the common thread because it's the common thread that draws us all together. Like, it's a double entendre on purpose. Like, it's not only about the thread as a fabric, but the thread of like the tapestry of a community.
Yeah, I get it. Like, and then you're already mentioning it, but I felt, knowing you a bit now or like following your work, that there's two big motives, which are somehow community, or which is community and cultural awareness,
are
big things you're working on.
Yes.
So,
and that's why I only do minority designers.
Yeah.
I only do minority fashion artisans. One, because for a lot of marginalized designers, they only have their immediate community, their friends and their family. That's who they're selling to. And that's not sustainable in the world that we live in, especially with the global wave of gentrification. So for me, the reason why I want to give them customers that wouldn't automatically think to come to them, who would innately love them, but just have never been exposed, have never been able to brush up against their brilliance. So I use my tours as a way to like broaden their audience, hopefully keep them, give them business that will keep them open for longer, but also inspire people from other countries to interact with their amazing genius. Like, they're so smart. Some of these designers are making such beautiful things, but they don't have the marketing budget for the world to know, and they don't have the connected friends or fathers to like give them the platform. So this is my form of activism. For me, my company is like, it's capital, but it's also activism, it's community development, it's all those things together in one.
And also, like, at the beginning of the tour, you were like, that was so nice how you were talking about in Harlem, how different, like, the customer and this relation to clothes, you know, and, like, maybe you can tell something about that again.
Yeah, so we live in a world of, like, fast fashion, and fast fashion is about getting the product off the shelf as quickly as possible. What I love about minority fashion, which is very much sustainable. So when you think about sustainable, you think of bamboo fabrics. You think about a girl who goes to Harvard, who goes to India and meets an artisan and like makes a cute website. But in many ways, local minority designers, they're sustainable fashion because it's slow fashion. They take time with their pieces. They invest in them. They hand make them. It's like a process. They don't make a ton. So for me, what I love about Harlem and most of the minority designers that I work with is that they love fashion so much, it's really not about the buck for them. Because if it was about the buck for them, they'd work for a big designer and churn out designs, and they would just be made all the time and sold all the time. For them, it's about the experience. It's about the engagement. It's about putting themselves into the clothing. It's about putting the consumer into the clothing as well. It's just such a customized experience. And we're losing that in fashion because it's all about the almighty dollar. It's about selling things as quickly as possible, always having something new on the shelf.
Yeah.
And these minority designs, they're sustainable designs. They don't get the same street cred as a white girl from Harvard, but they're slow fashion.
Yeah.
And the same ways that slow, sustainable fashion is such a necessity, not only for the world, but for the environment.
Yeah.
These minority designs are contributing to that movement, but they don't get the same exposure or the same shine or the same remuneration. And so I'm glad to give them a platform bigger than what they already have.
Yeah.
Let me pause for a second. It wasn't only Michaela and me sitting around a table, but another woman, another participant of the Harlem tour. She didn't mean to interrupt us, but these news were too fresh, too important not to share. Amber Geiger, a white off-duty police officer, was just found guilty for murdering Bothem Jean in his own apartment in Dallas. She tried to escape punishment by saying she thought it was her apartment and he trespassing. You will hear now how we found out about the news and all the happy reactions, because this is a justice which isn't a given in America.
You okay? Oh God, what news is it now?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I knew. Oh, they found her guilty! Oh my God, I thought they were going to let her off. Because she cried this week.
What?
And no disrespect, but white tears have a lot of weight. White tears have a lot of weight.
White girl too.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Yes.
So did you hear about this woman who walked into the wrong apartment and killed the man living in there?
No.
So she lived in an apartment that had called Cooker Cutty. It's like a very modern building where every building looks the same. She's a police woman. She walked into a man's house because his door didn't fully click. It was one of those electric locks. She thought she was in her apartment. Because he was a black man sitting on his couch eating ice cream, she saw him as an intruder, took out his gun, and killed him. Did not realize until after that she was not in her apartment. Let me point out some facts. He had a big red mat in front of his door. She did not. She had an island in her apartment. He did not. So even though the apartment was cookie cutter, if she had any presence of mind, she would have known that it wasn't her apartment.
Yeah.
But yet she defaulted to this black man as a threat to me.
And this week on the stand, she was like,
so happy about that.
I wish
and there was one point last week where I read an article, and I don't know if it was right, where even the prosecutor had said, I don't think she meant to kill him. And when I was like, why would he say that?
Yeah.
But then his closing argument was so good because he was like, he showed the red mat. He was like, he had a humongous red mat in front of his apartment. She did not. Like, how do you not
also
offset? Isn't that crazy? It's so crazy. Good question. Oh, that's where it was?
Yeah, Dallas.
Which is another thing, because Dallas is not black friendly. It is not black friendly. So I was like, his closing argument was so good, but I was sure. And then there was a point where they were going to try to ask for involuntary manslaughter. They were trying to reduce her stuff so much that I was like, she's going to get a year at best. Oh, that makes me so happy. Yeah, it's just sounds like murder.
So I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, that's the thing.
I'm just going to
Perfect. Perfect.
Last topic, which is casual awareness. What's going on.
So I also I do a lot of work around cultural appropriation, and my tours are the perfect place because I think for most white people, they don't mean to offend. They just don't know better, right? So with cultural appropriation, one of the biggest reasons why cultural appropriation gets perpetuated is because you don't know the history, right? So you see your really dope black shirt, and you're like, I love it. I'm going to wear it. And all that people are saying, you don't know the history. You don't know the context. You don't get to wear it unless you understand where it came from, what it meant to us. So on my tours, I'm providing that education, right? And I'm also giving you the insider scoop, hey,
that could be already a question.
Don't wear that because it's going
to take you to
find
out
and
about LA.
Black people in America are very comfortable intergroup between each other to talk about race, but they are deeply distrustful of white people and the ramifications of airing their racial grievances. So a lot of times, if they do say to a white person, it's either hyperbolic and lost in the passion in which they said, or it's not even said because we don't even want to get into this fight with you.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like my tours become this safe space where I'm very calmly explaining to you what it means to us, why we prefer you wouldn't wear it, and then you're able to receive it. It's not an impassioned soapbox here's the history. This is why we value it so much. And unless you experience this history, we prefer you to do
that.
It's told in a very loving and gentle way. And I think for a lot of people, they just need to hear it in a loving, gentle way. But a lot of times, when the And I believe there's a need for the passion. Like, I'm not mad at the backlash. Like, I'm not mad at, like, black people standing there pointing this passionately. I do it sometimes, too.
Okay.
But I know sometimes arguments can be undercut because people use your passion against you. So I like that in my tours, we can talk about it calmly and rationally. You know, I mean no hate. We're all in this together. But I want you to clearly understand this wasn't meant for you. Please don't do it. You know what I'm saying?
Totally. But is there something, because you are also teaching students and so on, like, and also, you know, I've been to the show of Anna's,
like,
Sweet.
A little game.
I want to go see that. Let's take some kids to go see it on December. Yeah. Did you love it?
Good. The first word is wardrobe. Yeah, like, in the show, it's called, like, she's, like, sourcing from all the culture.
Yes, yes.
And I was wondering what you would say about it. Like, what do you teach students how to source from different cultures in general? Is that something we could... You know?
So there's two things. The first is one of the benefits of my training as an anthropologist is that you learn how to go into communities outside of your own and be respectful about getting information. So for a long time, anthropology was a form of colonialism. White men going into places like Africa to learn information to help their government colonize, right? But as more and more throughout the years, especially as minorities became anthropologists, who were like, hey, not on my watch, that's not going to happen. So my training is in teaching people how to enter a community, ask for permission, get validation, be in conversation and collaboration. To me, that's what anthropology has become because of our colonial background, right? And so it makes it perfect for me to teach about how to approach cultural awareness in an engaged way, because I'm just using the tools that I use in anthropology. So again, I would never go and research a community and not say, is it okay if I do that? I'm being very transparent with my motives, my outcomes, and what I plan to gain. You're part of the conversation. So like, we're co-authoring this. Like, I might be the person who shares the information in a language that the audience understands, but it's your story. So you're as part of an author of this as I am, right? And then I'm asking if I'm understanding it right. I'm constantly going back and saying, did I get that right? Did I understand it right? Did I pick up on all the nuances? I think that's so critical and key. And for a lot of, in fashion in particular, it has a very strong problem of seeing fashion as visual and not cultural. So they see a beautiful picture of design and they're like, you know what, our next question, we're going to make that.
We're talking about that before too.
It makes me so angry without contacting somebody in that community, asking for permission. One of the reasons that happened is they don't want to share the profit, which is unfair because it's millions and millions of dollars and the creative inspiration is not your own. So pay where it's due. And they also don't want to be told no, because there are some communities that would say, there's Native American communities. And no, you can't use that headdress. Yes, the headdress you would make would be beautiful, but it's not yours. And we have a special ritual around headdresses, and every feather means something, and you won't... People who buy your stuff, they haven't earned those feathers, so you don't get to sell it to them. A lot of designers don't want to be told no. Fashion is a very entitled industry, especially if you make a lot of money in it, especially if you're a luxury brand. And so more than other industries where it's kind of obvious, like we know banking is predatory. Fashion has been predatory under the radar until like 10 years ago with Twitter and Instagram kind of calling people out. And so fashion has some catching up to do. And so my work is very much committed to being someone in the industry saying, yeah, that's not right, and this is how you do it better. And like, yeah, the profit margin might be a little bit smaller, but the appreciation will be more authentic than you seeing a picture and thinking, I really like this, I'm going to make it, and I'm going to make money from it, and never once engaging with that community. So with all my kids, I see my students as being the future generation of fashion. And they're on my watch, like, I'm committed to having those hard conversations with them, because on my watch, there won't be a Gucci, there won't be an H&M monkey scandal. None of my kids are doing that, because we're having those conversations in the classroom, and that's where to get them. Not when they're out in the world getting all these accolades for being so creative and not being told no. A lot of these big designers, they're never told no. So, of course, and a lot of them have their own inherent prejudices, so they don't even want to hear from, like, some indigenous person, like, how dare you tell me how to create, like, I make millions of dollars. But you don't get to use their stuff. It'd be like going to someone's home, taking something out of their closet, and then being like, why are you mad about it? Like, it's the same thing. It's that same feeling for a lot of marginalized communities. And I think we have to keep having these conversations out loud to change it. Case in point, Kardashians. Critical offenders of cultural appropriation all the time. Kim just changed her shapewear line from kimono to Skims. 10 years ago, she wouldn't have done that because she wouldn't have cared about the backlash. The more and more noise that is made about it, the more and more designers have to be held responsible for the creative choices that they make, especially when they're culturally inappropriate. And so, like, I want to be part of that conversation, because the more loudly we speak, the less likely will happen. The more likely marginalized designers will get profit margins for their creativity, which is incredibly important to their survival. So many minority designers, they get ripped off by someone like a Forever 21, or and then they go out of business. Like, they end up working desk jobs. Like, that's a disservice to the industry. That incredibly creative person is giving up on fashion. My boutiques that are closing because of gentrification, they're going back to Africa. They're not open. They're not working in fashion anymore. They were an asset to the industry. It's a loss for all of us when we lose these creatives, and so we have to create safe spaces for them. Like, we have to.
Amazing, yeah.
I'll be honest.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
But the more I did, the realized.
Okay, good, 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 good. I'm glad we could do this.
So I'm stepping in now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I had my own fashion line for 4 years, and I love fashion. I'm obsessed with fashion, but it never fulfilled
the way that this does now.
Why did it not? Like,
I think the fashion industry is an amazing industry, but I think it puts a lot of undue pressure on creatives. The proliferation of seasons, you know, back in the day we had 4 seasons, now we have like 16.
Yeah.
That need to constantly be putting out output, engaging new customers, that felt like a chore.
Yeah.
I just wanted to create. And I found, being a fashion designer, there were almost too many rules. I felt stifled.
Yeah.
What I like about my company now is there are no rules, because no one else is doing it, so I get to make it my own. And I miss the part of the culture. So I had a socially conscious fashion line, so I talked a lot about culture within the collection, but not to the degree that I do now. And I like the tours because I hope that it makes people think more critically about their own style and their own fashion.
Yeah.
I think people think of fashion as a very superficial industry, but it says so much about who you are. And so I wanted to empower people, in particular women, to be self-narrators. Like, I wanted them to be part of the narration of who you are to the world. So, like, rather than unconsciously putting on a dress that you bought because you saw it on a Kardashian, I want you to think about why you like that dress, why you like that color, why that cut worked with your body. It celebrated your Latin hips and your curves. Like, I wanted to tell that story. That's somewhat harder to do with a fashion line, because you mail out the clothes and they have it. But there's not much of a discussion. They come on the website, they like it, they wear it. The tours are a way where I can actually control the narrative and, like, really engage much more deeply about clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. And, like, it's like this umbrella project you're doing is called, if I Common Thread.
The Common Project. Thread Project, yep.
And I love the teaser, or how you write about it. It's like, for me, it's a teaser where you say, like, where Van Gogh, Gucci, sneakers, and female barbers aren't nearly as unrelated as they seem.
Right.
What do you mean by that, for someone who, you know?
So the cool thing about being an anthropologist is that you learn how history, politics, culture all come together to create a community as a society, and that happens with fashion. Such a good example, we were just on a tour and someone pointed out how the bubble of the 80s followed by a recession in the early 2000s affects the way fashion is impacted today for local fashion artisans. I think it's such a complex, intricate story, and like, fashion can be this amazing, it's like your favorite book. You love that book because you can deep dive into the characters and learn the nuances, and like, you learn about the history of their mother and how it affects them now, and how they date and their community and like the favorite foods. Like, it all comes together to tell the story of a person, and fashion is just like that. Like, you can't divorce fashion from politics. You can't divorce fashion from history. You can't divorce fashion from culture. And why would you? Because it only makes the fashion better. Because it's a story. So for me, I think about fashion as art, but I think of it as a story. Like, it's telling a story, and like, that's so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are really excited about it once they start thinking that way, but we're not programmed to think that way. So I see my company as a mission to push people to just think more critically about fashion so that they enjoy it more. It's so much more than just like, it makes me look pretty. It's telling your story. It's telling the story of the designer. It's telling the story of the artisans who use their hands to make it. The person who, like, worked at the mill, who made the fabric. Like, all that comes together to make this, like, beautifully intricate tapestry. It's, like, so awesome.
Yeah. And, like, in this case, like, it's maybe naive, but is there really a relation for you for, like, Van Gogh, Gucci sneakers, and or is that just, like, to...
No.
You
know? No, so... That's Harlem. Like, all those things are Harlem. And so in Harlem, fashion can be Dapper Dan, which is luxury, one of the few black designers in luxury. So the most opulent fabrics made in Italy, brought here. But then you go two blocks down, And it might be a another boutique that that it's all about, you know, that's where the abuela shop, you know, because they love the fabric that's there. Like, for me, it's about neighborhoods and communities as much as about fashion, and like what fashion lines or what small fashion businesses make sense in a neighborhood. It's telling the story of that community.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, especially a place like Harlem, there's people who are like third generation Harlemites, and then there's people like me who moved here because we're ambitious and we want to make the most of the world. But we all live together side by side, right on top of each other, and we all contribute to the culture of this place. And I might, if you had asked me, do I have a lot in common with someone who's been in Harlem for like 10 years, I'd say, no, I'm Jamaican. I grew up in Florida. I'm so different. But being forced to live in a neighborhood together, we have formed this community and that bond that we are connected. And some of that is through clothing, and I love that. I love that. It's the common thread, because it's the common thread that draws us all together. Like, it's a double entendre on purpose. Like, it's not only about the thread as a fabric, but the thread of like the tapestry of a community.
Yeah, again, it's like a metaphor too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're already mentioning it, but I felt knowing you a bit now, or like following your work, that there's two big motives, which are somehow community, or which is community and cultural awareness.
Yes.
Like, are big things you're working on.
Yes.
So,
and that's why I only do minority designers.
Yeah.
I only do minority fashion artisans. One, because for a lot of marginalized designers, they only have their immediate community, their friends and their family. That's who they're selling to. And that's not sustainable in the world that we live in, especially with the global wave of gentrification. So for me, the reason why I want to give them customers that wouldn't automatically think to come to them, who would innately love them, but just have never been exposed, have never been able to brush up against their brilliance. So I use my tours as a way to like broaden their audience, hopefully keep them, give them business that will keep them open for longer, but also inspire people from other countries to interact with their amazing genius. Like, they're so smart. Some of these designers are making such beautiful things, but they don't have the marketing budget for the world to know, and they don't have the connected friends or fathers to like give them the platform. So this is my form of activism. For me, my company is like, it's capital, but it's also activism, it's community development, it's all those things together in one.
And also, like, at the beginning of the tour, you were like, that was so nice how you were talking about in Harlem, how different, like, the customer and this relation to clothes, you know, and like, maybe you can tell something about that again.
Yeah, so we live in a world of like fast fashion, and fast fashion is about getting the product off the shelf as quickly as possible. What I love about minority fashion, which is very much sustainable. So when you think about sustainable, you think of bamboo fabrics, you think about a girl who goes to Harvard, who goes to India and meets an artisan and like makes a cute website. But in many ways, local minority designers, they're sustainable fashion because it's slow fashion. They take time with their pieces. They invest in them. They hand make them. It's like a process. They don't make a ton. So for me, what I love about Harlem and most of the minority designers that I work with is that they love fashion so much, it's really not about the buck for them. Because if it was about the buck for them, they'd work for a big designer and churn out designs, and they would just be made all the time and sold all the time. For them, it's about the experience, it's about the engagement, it's about putting themselves into the clothing, it's about putting the consumer into the clothing as well. It's just such a customized experience, and we're losing that in fashion because it's all about the almighty dollar. It's about selling things as quickly as possible, always having something new on the shelf.
Yeah.
And these minority designers, they're sustainable designers. They don't get the same street cred as the white girl from Harvard, but they're slow fashion. And the same ways that slow, sustainable fashion is such a necessity, not only for the world, but for the environment, these minority designers are contributing to that movement, but they don't get the same exposure or the same shine or the same remuneration. And so I'm glad to give them a platform bigger than what they already have.
Yeah.
You okay? Oh, God, what news is it now?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I knew. Oh, they found her guilty! Oh, my God, I thought they were going to let her off. Because she cried this week. What? And no disrespect, but white tears have a lot of weight. White tears have a lot of weight.
White girl tears.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Yes.
So did you hear about this woman who walked into the wrong apartment and killed the man living in there?
No.
So she lived in an apartment that had like called Cooker Cuddy. It's like a very like modern building where every building looks the same. She's a police woman. She walked into a man's house because his door didn't fully click. It was one of those electric locks. She thought she was in her apartment. Because he was a black man sitting on his couch eating ice cream, she saw him as an intruder, took out his gun, and killed him. Did not realize until after that she was not in her apartment. Let me point out some facts. He had a big red mat in front of his door. She did not. She had an island in her apartment. he did not. So even though the apartment was cookie cutter, if she had any presence of mind, she would have known that it wasn't her apartment.
Yeah.
But yet she defaulted to this black man as a threat to me, and she killed him. Hi, Blue.
Rubina?
Rubina's me. I got
this
you.
Is you, right?
Thank you.
Oh, I think I didn't order.
I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. No, I didn't know what you wanted.
No, yeah,
thank
sorry,
you so
I
much.
I didn't get a whole like a cappuccino. I would love to.
More large.
Large.
Okay.
Baby girl, can I have some milkadamia? I'm obsessed with milkadamia.
That's good.
Is
okay.
It so delicious? Have you tried it?
I tried it once.
You didn't like it?
No.
Do you not like sweet milk?
I like oat.
Oh, I don't like oat because it has that residue in the mouth. Like, you know, like matcha, like it's still in your mouth.
I know what you say. It is thick. But,
oh my God! Okay, so we're milk enemies, but I still love you. We're milk enemies, but I really do love you. Thank you so much, my love. Thank you so much.
How long did you want to try?
Do you want regular milk or you want to try the milk? Okay, perfect.
I'm a big fan of regular milk.
I really honestly thought, because she cried and she said this week on the stand, she was like, "If I could, I wish I had died."
Yeah.
And her story. Shit.
So do you not believe her? Because I thought that she might have liked him and he had rejected her or something.
I think they had something going on. I think she
I thought
went,
that when I first heard
I
it.
I think she went, I think maybe they had a tiff.
Or he did rebuffed her.
Or he rebuffed
yeah,
her.
Yeah, I thought that too.
And
what's
she
a
was,
tiff? Sorry.
Like a fight, a little spat. A little spat.
Yeah, lover spat. Yeah. Lover spat.
I thought that too.
I think they had a lover
but it never
spat.
Came out. It never came out or that they knew each other.
Or she like, or something. Something happened.
You're so funny that you say that. Because I thought that when I first read the story, I was like, she probably hollered at him and he was like, I'm not interested. And she was mad about it.
And her, like, some, especially to her being a police officer.
Yes,
yes.
She'd
have been like, oh,
fuck you.
You don't get the, you better love me.
Yeah.
Right, right.
You don't get to get it. And it just hit her the wrong way. And she was like.
I'm so glad you said that because no one has said that.
You know, or she like rolled up thinking, oh, I'll roll up. And
he's gonna be so happy I'm here.
And he's gonna be so happy, and I'll roll up, and you know.
And he's probably like, "What the fuck are you doing in my apartment?"
Yeah, like I'm feeling sexy. I'll go knock on his
door. Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, "What the fuck are you
get
doing
out my
in
house?"
And
no
she,
way.
And she might have gotten nervous because it's trespassing. Like she probably felt entitled.
She had a had a boyfriend. She had a white boyfriend who was on the police force.
Yeah, who she was supposedly sexing. So she said the reason why she didn't realize it wasn't her house because she was sexting her boyfriend as she walked in. But the fact that you saw a black man and your first instinct is to shoot him to death.
Yeah.
Like, even if all of that was true, the first question is, what are you doing here? He was sitting on his couch in joggers,
you know?
Eating ice cream.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not even like he had a gun. Like, she's lucky. I have some family members, they would have reached for their gun. Like, legally, like, their legal guns and been like, get the fuck out of my house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he probably was like, what are you doing here?
If he did not, so yes, you know, I can't believe they did.
I love it. And you know what, so, because
I'm not afraid that she's not going to
Yeah, because a lot of times
like,
when black men get killed
like,
in America, the people, especially if it's a cop, they always get off.
Yeah.
The only black only police who have gotten put into jail for that have been black police. Like, when a black police has killed another black person, they've gone to jail, but never.
Not even another black person. It's almost always, it was a black police officer that killed a white woman
in the Ethiopian guy.
Minneapolis.
Yes. He went to prison.
He went to jail.
Yeah, he went to
but
prison.
Even when police officers of color.
Oh, true.
Kill
other black people, they get off.
They get off.
Yeah. I am so happy about that. And there was one point last week where I read an article, and I don't know if it was right, where even the prosecutor had said, I don't think she meant to kill him. And when I was like, why would he say that?
Yeah.
But then his closing argument was so good because he was like, he showed the red mat. He was like, he had a humongous red mat in front of his apartment. She did not.
Yeah.
Like, how do you not notice
also,
that?
Like,
thank you, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Thank you. There's so many parts of that story that sounds so crazy.
It's so crazy.
Yeah. And the way the FOP came in and all that stuff, it was just,
What's the FOP?
FOP is the Fraternal Order of Police. Police officers.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And the president of the FOP was the, like there on the scene, like having a say in this collection.
Yes.
It was just shady as fuck. The whole thing was just shady.
Where was it actually?
Good question. Oh, that's where it was?
Yeah, Dallas.
Which is another thing because Dallas is not black friendly.
Yeah.
It is not black friendly. So I was like, his closing argument was so good, but I was sure. And then there was a point where they were going to try to ask for like involuntary manslaughter. They were like trying to reduce her stuff so much that I was like, she's going to get a year at best.
That's crazy. How much
that makes
she
me
get
so
now?
Happy. Yeah, it sounds like murder.
So I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't
know that. No, that's big. I need to know that.
It leads me to the end somehow.
Perfect.
Like,
perfect.
The last topic, which is cultural awareness. Like, it's like it showed like what's going on.
So I also like, I do a lot of work around cultural appropriation, and my tours are the perfect place because I think for most white people, they don't mean to offend. They just don't know better, right? So with cultural appropriation, one of the biggest reasons why cultural appropriation gets perpetuated is because you don't know the history, right? So you see a really dope black shirt and you're like, I love it, I'm gonna wear it. And all that people are saying, like, you don't know the history, you don't know the context, like, you don't get to wear it unless you understand where it came from, what it meant to us. So on my tours, I'm providing that education, right? And I'm also giving you the insider scoop, like, hey, don't wear that because it's gonna piss some people off.
Yeah.
And black people in America are very comfortable intra-group between each other to talk about race, but they are deeply distrustful of white people and the ramifications of airing their racial grievances. So a lot of times, if they do say to a white person, it's either hyperbolic and lost in the passion in which they said, or it's not even said because we don't even want to like get into this fight with you. I feel like my tours become this safe space where I'm very calmly explaining to you what it means to us, why we prefer you wouldn't wear it, and then you're able to receive it. It's not an impassioned soapbox like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's like, here's the history, this is why we value it so much, and unless you experience this history, we prefer you didn't do it. It's told in a very loving and gentle way, and I think for a lot of people, they just need to hear it in a loving, gentle way, but a lot of times, and I believe there's a need for the passion. Like, I'm not mad at the backlash. Like, I'm not mad at, like, black people stating their opinions passionately. I do it sometimes, too, but I know sometimes arguments can be undercut because people use your passion against you. So I like that in my tours, we can talk about it calmly and rationally. You know, I mean no hate. We're all in this together. But I want you to clearly understand this wasn't meant for you. Please don't do it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Totally. But is there something, because you are also teaching students and so on, like, and also, you know, I've been to the show of Anna Sui. I don't know.
If I want to go see that. I'm going to take some kids to go see it on December. Yeah, good. Did you love it?
I loved it.
Good, 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 good.
And I was thinking about you because it's written very big. And she's a Chinese.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But like in the show, it's called like she's like sourcing from all the cultures.
Yes, yes.
And I was wondering what you would say about that. Like, what do you teach students how to source from different cultures in general? Is that something we could, you know?
So there's two things. The first is one of the benefits of my training as an anthropologist is that you learn how to go into communities outside of your own and be respectful about getting information. So for a long time, anthropology was a form of colonialism. White men going into places like Africa to learn information to help their government colonize, right? But as more and more throughout the years, especially as minorities became anthropologists, we were like, hey, not on my watch, that's not gonna happen. So my training is in teaching people how to enter a community, ask for permission, get validation, be in conversation and collaboration. To me, that's what anthropology has become because of our colonial background, right? And so it makes it perfect for me to teach about how to approach cultural awareness in an engaged way because I'm just using the tools that I use in anthropology. So again, I would never go and research a community and not say, is it okay if I do that? I'm being very transparent with my motives, my outcomes, and what I plan to gain. You're part of the conversation, so like we're co-authoring this. Like, I might be the person who shares the information in a language that the audience understands, but it's your story, so you're as part of an author of this as I am, right? And then I'm asking if I'm understanding it right. I'm constantly going back and saying, did I get that right? Did I understand it right? Did I pick up on all the nuances? I think that's so critical and key. And for a lot of, in fashion in particular, it has a very strong problem of seeing fashion as visual and not cultural.
Totally.
So they see a beautiful picture of design and they're like, you know what, our next question, we're gonna make that.
We were talking about that before too.
It makes me so angry without contacting somebody in that community, asking for permission. One of the reasons that happened is they don't want to share the profit, which is unfair because it's millions and millions of dollars and the creative inspiration is not your own, so pay where it's due. And they also don't want to be told no because there are some communities that would say, there's Native American communities, no, you can't use that headdress. Yes, the headdress you would make would be beautiful, but it's not yours. And we have a special ritual around headdresses and every feather means something and you won't, people who buy your stuff, they haven't earned those feathers so you don't get to sell it to them. A lot of designers don't want to be told no. Fashion is a very entitled industry, especially if you make a lot of money in it, especially if you're a luxury brand. And so more than other industries where it's kind of obvious, like we know banking is predatory. Fashion has been predatory under the radar until like 10 years ago with Twitter and Instagram kind of calling people out. And so fashion has some catching up to do. And so my work is very much committed to being someone in the industry saying, yeah, that's not right, and this is how you do it better. And like, yeah, the profit margin might be a little bit smaller, but the appreciation will be more authentic than you seeing a picture and thinking, I really like this, I'm gonna make it, and I'm gonna make money from it, and never once engaging with that community. So with all my kids, I see my students as being the future generation of fashion, and they're on my watch, like, I'm committed to having those hard conversations with them, because on my watch, there won't be a Gucci. There won't be an H&M monkey scandal. None of my kids are doing that, because we're having those conversations in the classroom, and that's where to get them. Not when they're out in the world getting all these accolades for being so creative and not being told no. A lot of these big designers, they're never told no. So, of course, and a lot of them have their own inherent prejudices, so they don't even want to hear from, like, some indigenous person, like, how dare you tell me how to create, like, I make millions of dollars. But you don't get to use their stuff. It'd be like going to someone's home, taking something out of their closet, and then being like, why are you mad about it? Like, it's the same thing. It's that same feeling for a lot of marginalized communities. And I think we have to keep having these conversations out loud to change it. Case in point, Kardashians, critical offenders of cultural appropriation all the time. Kim just changed her shapewear line from kimono to Skims. 10 years ago, she wouldn't have done that because she wouldn't have cared about the backlash. The more and more noise that is made about it, the more and more designers have to be held responsible for the creative choices that they make, especially when they're culturally inappropriate. And so, like, I want to be part of that conversation, because the more loudly we speak, the less likely it will happen. The more likely marginalized designers will get profit margins for their creativity, which is incredibly important to their survival. So many minority designers, they get ripped off by someone like a Forever 21, and then they go out of business. Like, they end up working desk jobs. Like, that's a disservice to the industry. That incredibly creative person is giving up on fashion. My boutiques that are closing because of gentrification, they're going back to Africa. They're not working in fashion anymore. They were an asset to the industry. It's a loss for all of us when we lose these creatives, and so we have to create safe spaces for them. Like, we have to.
Amazing, yeah. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you so
Cheers.
Much.
Cheers. Okay, I'm pleased.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Good. I'm glad we could do this.
So I'm stopping it now.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.